spike my shots in there.
Thinking more about last day, but whatever floats your brain.
You guys having a good show?
Yeah.
Alright. This is the 10th anniversary Dynamite Comedy Hour, brought to you by... Okay, so... Alright, so let's introduce everybody here. I'm Molly Mahan. I am an associate editor at Dynamite. I work on the stinky Red Sonja. Yeah, I help with the stinky Red Sonja.
Stinky.
We got three Red Sonja writers up here right now, so this is exciting. let's start with Dwayne. Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm just Dwayne, like Cher. No, Dwayne Swierczynski. I write X-Con, a brand new series from Dynamite, so I'm new to the family.
Yay! It's part of our creator and
yes.
Sweet. I'm Gail Simone, and I'm writing Red Sonja, Legends of Red Sonja.
I'm Mark Wade. Please don't get up. I've written a lot for Dynamite over the last 10 years, most recently Green Hornet, and there's other things that are coming up that we maybe talk about, but right now we're talking about Dr. Spectre, I guess, is the most current thing, right?
Yeah.
For the Green Gold line, so, pretty busy. And you?
My name is Krista Blanche, and I'm also new to the Dynamite family. I am writing a book called The Damnation of Charlie Wormwood that is coming out October 1st. It was a webcomic that Dynamite decided to take a chance on me, so thanks, Dynamite.
I'm Frank Thierry. I'm writing Red Sonja, the Black Tower, the only comic I guarantee you up here where a guy loses his wang in a knife fight.
I think our wedding album had a guy who was the wine and knife fight.
Spoilers. The stakes have been set.
I'm Garth Ennis, and it's far too early for this.
I'm John Cassidy. We were doing shots last week.
Yes. Yes.
I'm Bill Willingham. I write Red Sonja. I'm the main Red Sonja writer for Dynamite. And I write the Phantom, and I write Green Hornet. I write Flash Gordon, and I write
Silver Star and Captain Victory,
and Zorro. I write Zorro for Dynamite.
What do you not write?
What don't you write?
I'm the main writer for. No, I write a book called Legendary that takes all of those people and squishes them together in a new. Steampulp kind of milieu. So there.
Thank you. John, my first question's for you.
That's right.
Since this is the 10th anniversary for Dynamite, you're one of the few who have been here since pretty much the Nations with Red Sonja number 1 back in 2005.
The first thing they did?
No, Army of Darkness was a few months before, but nobody here worked on that, I don't think. So, how have you seen the company develop in that time?
Well, it started off, it seems to me it started, I wish Nick was here to speak of it.
He's dead. Nick Fuchs is dead.
Yeah, he died this morning. He died. 10 years. Yeah.
Was he with you guys last night?
Yes, yes. That would explain his actions.
He is the culprit who purchased said
shots at 2 in the morning, and that's why he's dead.
But what I can say about it is it seemed like they were branching out, doing a couple of titles here and there, and it seems like a year later, they had a line of books coming out, and he was being very smart about choosing, properties out there that people wanted to see that they hadn't seen in a while. I can say myself, we kept talking about the Lone Ranger. He kind of knew I was a fan, and it was a perfect sort of boutique book. No one was looking to do the Lone Ranger at that time anyhow, so he jumped right on it, and we put a team together, and I'll say this, not knowing where they were going to be, it's amazing that 10 years later, they have such a line of books out, and they're such a prominent figure in the comic world. Because there would be something like the Lone Ranger, but then he would pick maybe Army of Darkness and whatever. Sometimes I wasn't quite sure where he was going with it, but it seems to have all worked out. But as a publisher, I really love that Dynamite stuck with something like the Lone Ranger. We did 25 issues with the same team. That's pretty amazing. There wasn't a new number one after six. They didn't do like 12 and decided to reboot over and over. They had the same guys. If something ran a little late, they gave it the time to be there, but it was the same crew all the way through. And that's pretty unique to any publisher right now.
Speaking of long runs, Gail, we just put issue 12 of Red Sonja to press. What should we be looking for in the next arc as issue 12 finished up, part two?
Well, the first arc was kind of a serious arc. The second arc was a little bit more humorous, and the third arc is a little bit more emotional. And it's Red Sonja. It's going after the person that she feels burned down her village and killed her family. And so we're going to find out if she's a good person or not a good person. We don't know yet, and we'll find out as she confronts this person in the story.
And Garth, we started our relationship with you, my understanding, with The Boys.
That's right.
Which originally was a Wildstorm title. How did that transition over to Dynamite?
It was what you might call a happy accident. DC, Wildstorm, but DC is the text from beyond the grave. Wildstorm, DC, published the first six issues, and then they decided they didn't want to go on with it because it was a bit rude. And they cut me loose, and I had a brief period where, frankly, every other publisher, bar Marvel, wanted to take it on. And I even talked to them briefly at one point. So everyone made me an offer, and I talked it over with the artist, Derek Robertson, and eventually, partly from consideration and partly from some advice we got, we went with Dynamite. And as I say, it's a happy accident, but it's proven to be one of the most rewarding partnerships of my entire career. Working with Nicky Barucci and Joe Ryman has been excellent. And The Boys led to Battlefields, led to Red Team. There's going to be another series coming out next year. It's worked out great. It got me out of the mainstream and into independent comics, where my career has really pretty much proceeded from. And that has been a huge boon. It really has. It's worked out great.
Good to hear. And I have a question as well for you. What led to the decision to go from the web with Charlie Wormwood to print with us?
Well, that was kind of a happy accident also. I'm hoping that my career will be like yours.
Kill more people.
Exactly.
I'm working on it.
Can we say George R. R. Martin would be happy with me? So I read this webcomic, and it's been up on Berlin.com for quite some time. That's my first comic. I've been a fan forever, and I teach about comics, but this is my first time writing one. And I started getting invited to conventions, and that got me thinking, I read a webcomic, so what am I going to do at conventions? You know, do you want me to sign your iPad? So we just printed up a kind of an ash can version, which is available at downstairs at Dynamite.
2005.
Yeah.
So
she's going to be signed. Yes. And then Nikki, who, you know, rest in peace, asked, you know, why I printed that up, and I said, well, I have to sign something.
These kids are coming at the wrong time.
Yeah.
They don't want to go ahead.
And he thought that I'd taken it to Image and all of that. Oh, I haven't taken it anywhere. I just needed something to sign. And so he said that Molly and Josh were fans of the comic and really wanted to print it. And so we just worked out a deal. So it was one of those, you know, I'll pay you later. So, it just worked out.
Awesome. And Bill, with Legendary, you're working with a lot of different licensed characters in an environment that they've never been in before. What's it like creating this retro Victorian steampunk punky world with like steampunk barbarians and horror icons like Vampiro?
Horror icons, she said.
Horror.
Not the other.
She's a nice lady. How dare you?
It was interesting. I've known Nikki since, well, he was a obnoxious kid hanging around the local comic shop. And so when I met him years later, and it turns out that he had gone on to great success and bought everything he wanted and had a company, of course, we had to do something together someday. And he would run characters by me, these lovely array of characters that Dynamite had the rights to do comics with. The unfortunate thing is that each character had someone else also doing a book. I mean, Lone Ranger, and I wanted to do a Lone Ranger Phantom crossover because the Phantom was still around. Well, a different one was around. Things like that. But in every case, someone else was also doing the book. And the one thing I did not want to do is to step on any other writer's toes. I don't care about the rights holders, the corporations that own the characters, but the other writers, people I know in the business. I don't want to step on their toes. I remember when we were doing this vast Batman crossover at DC, and for some reason I was the one who told Gail Simone that we were blowing up the clock tower while she was still writing. Even though I was not the one who decided to do that, I delivered the bad news, and Gail very rightfully got very stabby at me. Because it's the first you heard about it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I didn't want that kind of thing to do, so I kept telling Nick, like, I'll do just about any character, but I don't want to do any character in which someone else is also doing it, because I don't want to do that. And he came to me with the genius idea, says, well, what if you could do any character you want, or all the characters you want, but we do brand new versions of them in a new world, and he wanted me to do a steampunk thing. I said, that's genius. That takes care of all my problems. And because it was a new world, I asked, like, can I get every character? And we finally stopped. I mean, there were others that we could have added to this. Six license holders is a lot to juggle. But then again, I don't care about that because they have to deal with them. All I care about is people I'm likely to meet on panels and such that will say, how dare you do this when I was doing this, etc., etc. And I had this world legendary pre-made. About a year ago, I made this world just knowing that I'd find a story for it someday. And so when Nick talked about steampunk, I have a steampunk world. I actually prefer the term steampulp because I don't think these guys are punks. It's Robert Louis Stevenson. Those guys were gentlemen adventurers, not punks. Anyway, steampulp. I said, that's my water. I said, I have this world available already. Let's go. And it went from there. And it was just fun because there was no way to get it wrong. A few things. I thought for sure the license holders when I told them that the $6 million man would now be the $6,000 man, because back then that was a lot of money. And I thought, because that's like a trademark name. And I guess it just went through just fine.
Yeah.
So I get to do all sorts of fun things. And no one could say different. But then, because of the whole Watchtower thing, clock tower thing, Gail turned around.
It's suddenly my fault. I don't know.
And she stole Red Sonja's horse from my book. She is a horse thief.
Clover hasn't shown up.
That's your motivation. You want us to be equal.
Yeah.
I retract. That's not happening.
This is why I have them on opposite sides.
It's the long, hard track to redemption. Yeah. So, anyway, all of that was in it, and it was very fun to do. Did I answer your question in there?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Somewhere.
All right.
Answers. Mark, you're working on the Gold Key line right now.
Yeah.
Last issue's
about to come out. Yeah.
Very exciting. What was it like creating or recreating a world that has been gone for about like 15 years?
Longer in a lot of ways. I mean, when Nikki first came to me and rolled out, here are the Gold Key characters we want to revive. You know, three of them were characters that had been redone a couple of times since their original incarnations. Which was interesting to me, but not as interesting as when we threw out Dr. Spectre, who was one of these characters who was so obscure that even I had read very little of Dr. Spector, and I read everything. So I seized on that. It's like, well, and I'm pretty sure that's not quite where Nicky wanted me to go. But I didn't care, because I thought, well, that's something that you can really kind of get in and sink your teeth into and not have to feel like you're competing with the most recent incarnation of that character. But instead, this is something that most of the people who read Dr. Spector are actually dead now. That's really key. And so we use that character as the linchpin to sort of put together the rest of the Goki universe in ways that you've kind of seen a little bit in issue 3, and then it'll kind of become fully explained in issue 4. But again, very cooperative, very collaborative. Everybody's getting each other's scripts and taking a look at what the other writers are doing, and it was really a lot of fun to do. It's very rare that you can do a shared universe thing like that, especially when you're building it from the ground up, and still feel like you've got a lot of autonomy in there. So, all good.
Why Red Sonja, Frank?
Why the hell not? Well, my story's kind of like Bill, meaning that Nikki broke my balls until I finally did something for the company, and which is the character I was most interested in.
I want to make sure people can hear you.
I'm sure they can hear me, all right?
Start counting how many times he says balls.
Excellent. I'm going to count that. It's one of yours now. All right, balls. That's twice. Okay. He wanted me to do Red Sonja. He's been talking about that for forever. So finally, I agreed to do Red Sonja. We were going to do a miniseries. And with the Black Tower, I wanted to do something that was a bit different, so it's kind of more like a Stephen King story in a way, because it's this mysterious tower shows up, people start going nuts, we don't know where it came from, what it is, Sonja shows up, starts killing a lot of people because they're going nuts, and guy loses a wang in a knife fight. Not balls, okay? It's the whole thing. I think it's the whole package there. So,
That's five.
I said package. I didn't say balls. We got to count them up here. I don't know if six? All right. Shut up, you. And then what we find out is in the tower, we'll start to get a hint of it in issue 2. And it's, believe me, people are not going to expect what it is. What is it and what it means. There's really a big shock at the end of issue 2, I would say, with a reveal there. And slowly we start to find out exactly what's in the tower. And it's, like I said, it's very different than what, in my mind, what Sonja's ever faced before.
No spoilers. Issue 1 is out and at 2005 Dynamite booth.
Signing.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you for that. So at Dynamite, we're known for having fairly violent titles, a lot of action, adventure. What's it like for you guys as writers and you, John, as an artist, to do with those scenes? Do you find it cathartic? Do you get like a lot of your own rage out in those moments, or do you just do it because you know that our audience is expecting it and it has to happen? Anybody?
This is about violence?
Yeah, violence.
Well, it's comic books. I mean, whatever company it is, you're getting that same kind of, feel. I think maybe, just again, I think Nikki's, Dynamite's picked, they talk to creators. He's talked to creators and finds out the characters they like, and he kind of figures out what's available, or if it's original content, he finds out, how far can we push this? Things you're not going to be able to do over at, to bigger companies. So there's more leeway, and I think even with licensed characters, I think you guys have been really good about finessing it and pushing those boundaries to where maybe normally you wouldn't see the Phantom or a different character, in these circumstances. But I think it's fun to see them in a different light, and maybe, I don't know if we're seeing them more in a more violent way, but we're seeing them not so protected. They don't have to just shoot the gun out of the hand. The bullet can go through the brain every once in a while.
Yeah, it's sort of like having parents who are out back smoking pot while you're putting your stories up, whereas versus the parents who are attentive. That must be slacker parents. You're out back, not paying attention to the kids too much. So that's how I feel, at least.
Okay.
Also both.
How dare you? I care about my children.
Oh, just put that out back. Come on.
Here's the thing for me. Writing Red Sonja, yes, it's going to be violent. It's a barbarian comic, and one of the things that I love about writing barbarian comics, especially for Dynamite as opposed to when I sneak them in at other companies, is that the roundedness, the realness, and you don't have to skirt around that blood and mud and over-drinking and being over or under-sexed. Or, you know, smelling bad and not being glamorous. You can tell some stories that we don't really see at the Big Two that much. And Dynamite is great about, if you come to them with an idea, like I said, well, I would kind of like to do Red Sonja, but can we, instead of doing kind of what we normally do on the covers, can we please hire all these fantastic female artists and put them on the covers? And they're like, yes, let's do that. Who do you want? And then I send in a list, and they get everybody, and they're just kind of in on the deal. And for that, even if that could have or would have happened at another company, it would have been 3 weeks minimum of meetings, and then someone would have said no at the end of that. So this is a company where they're willing to take chances, and we see that those chances pay off, and they can work, and people enjoy them. And they don't care if Red Sonja smells bad and doesn't get laid for 6 issues.
I can't.
Well, then you can read the next article.
Is that she less smelling than that song?
She may work on her hygiene a little.
Is this a good time to announce Dynamite's new Smello comics?
Yes. Smello-vision. Scratch and sniff comics.
Well, then she'll definitely take a bath.
And that's all the questions I had, unless anybody else has an answer. Violence into it? No?
I wanted to hear John talk, answer the specifically the, does he get his rage out? Because he has a lot of rage.
No. Next question.
Does anybody have any questions from the audience now? Yes. You, yeah.
Oh, for the guy, people, gals and girl, or guys and girls writing Red Sonja right now, A, what's your favorite thing about writing her? And B, is there anything you guys do, like music you listen to or something you watch that like gets you pumped up and ready to write her?
Watch. Maybe you really don't want to know what I watch. I want to answer that question.
What I kind of like about writing Red Sonja is, you know, she's pretty open and raw, and that's a fun way to tell a story, to be unrestrained in so many ways. So I love that. And I'm one of those writers that I'm impossible to live with. Sorry, Rocket Spouse. But I have to have total and complete silence. People can't be talking outside my office door. I can't hear people talking on the television outside my office door because I start typing words that I'm hearing. And so everything's happening up in here, and that's where it all stays until it gets onto the keyboard.
Do you listen to music at all?
Not while I'm writing.
Not even, like, non-lyric, like
nope.
Classical?
Because, I mean, soundtracks I can do, but that's about it. That's the limit.
If I'm doing corrections or email-type things or plotting, it's things that are a little bit looser. But when I'm actually writing characters' dialogue, figuring out the choreography that needs to happen, you know, if I'm making sense from page to page as it turns all those things and puzzle pieces that need to fit, I have to have total and complete concentration. Otherwise, you get chased out of the house.
Can't you just buy her a hyperbaric chamber or something?
Now, you think that's funny, but you don't know how many times I've said, I really wish I had an isolation chamber.
You just bought a house.
Yeah, look who's talking. What a house.
We got a question about X-Con.
Yeah, okay. Amazing comedy.
No, thank you.
You're a crime writer.
Wait, raise the flag again before you ask the question.
You're a crime writer.
Yeah.
Both fiction and nonfiction before you became a comic book writer. And I was just noticing you really managed to capture a lot of voices, you know, the way people talk, the dialogue and everything else. You move things along very quickly. Was it hard for you to transfer your skills, your storytelling style from that text where you could use 80 pages or 120 pages to going to a set number of pages, you know, every month to chunking out your stories? Did that change the way you narrate? Did it change the way you flow a story out?
Great question. I mean, actually, my training originally was as a journalist. I was a reporter, so that helped both my novels and comics, because in journalism, you have 800 words and no more. I'm used to writing for a certain, you know, space back then. I used to cut down, you know, 2,000 word departments to, like, you know, 600 words sometimes, you know, so I know how to cut. And as far as the voices, same thing as a reporter, I like to listen to people talk and how they talk. I love being a fly on the wall. I'm kind of creepy that way. You know, I'm going to lurk behind you, you know, and kind of hear the way you say things. And that finds its way into books and in comics as well. In comics, the tools you have visuals, you have captions sometimes, but your dialogue is kind of what really carries a story. So I think my reporting background came in handy, I think.
I think it works out pretty well. XCon number one, also available at the Dynamite booth. You'll be signing all weekend. 2005 Dynamite booth.
Balls.
Anybody else? Questions? Comments? Yes.
Most of you, if not all of you, have written for the Big Two or imprints. How does it differ? They're both established characters, whether you're writing for DC, Marvel, or Dynamite, but Dynamite seems to kind of have chunks or reset more often. How do you feel that the characters are different? Is it more freeing? Is it harder to write since you don't have a continuity that's going on? Anybody?
Well, not having a continuity is glorious. yeah. That I don't know how others feel. It makes it so much easier. And when you do like an alternate world version of a beloved character, it's the ultimate freedom in the sense that you get to ignore anything you want, but like a buffet, you pick the good parts of what you're wanting to use, and that's it. The struggles with this series had nothing whatsoever to do with the continuity of the character. That was totally free.
I'll give you a good example, okay? Back when I wrote Wolverine, we had a cover where, actually in one of the stories, a guy pulls out Wolverine's eyeball and eats it, okay? I caught a lot of crap for that. With Dynamite, forget about it. They got the alternate cover, okay?
We have 50 variants of that issue.
Yeah, well, there's the alternate cover that they got over here. The guy's getting stabbed right in the head, boom, on the cover. Yeah, all right, fine.
2005.
For me, what I like and one of the big differences is if you have a story in mind, you can see it through to the completion and not get derailed by that too much. And that is when you have a particular story or a particular direction that you want to take a character, that is extremely wonderful to be able to say, this is what I have in mind for this character. They say they like the idea, and then they send it to the licensor, they like the idea, then go. And then you're, you know, left to do your best work writing that story that's been approved. And it's really remarkable.
So I have a question on that note. Do licensors ever freak out about some things that...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Any pushback?
Oh, yeah. I can't go into too much detail, but there was a story that we were working on that I was up until, like, 2 in the morning emailing the writers and the artists, making sure that it could go to print the next day, because the licensor... There's a lot of confusion about what the licensor was asking as well. But we can have things straight up said.
That was one of Frank's books, right?
Yes.
Kind of curious. Working with licensors to me seemed it would be another stage of people second-guessing your stuff. But it almost seemed to work out well in the Freedom Department in that it's such a hassle to go. And with my book, as Molly said, there were six licensors involved.
Yeah.
To get all those permissions to do it, when that permission comes back, the one thing you can guarantee is that Dynamite is not going to mess with your story anymore, because it was such a hassle to get permissions the first time that you know. The hardest thing in the world is to work with Marvel DC and start a new series or whatever and get, okay, can I have this character? Can I have this permit? Can I do this? And get yes, yes, yes all the way down. Make your plans, and then in the middle of your storyline, them changing their mind and saying, no, that character's got to die in this thing, and you have to do that, and you have to blow up the watchtower, et cetera, et cetera.
That's with the watchtower.
Well,
can we have a watchtower?
My guilt is vast. Yeah.
Trump must have really reacted more strongly.
Would you like kidnap his family?
You were mad and angry and stabby.
Let's check the Twitter feed. What?
Okay. Hashtag balls.
Anybody else? Questions? Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Ennis. I think I read an interview where your take on your book, The Boys, was pretty much of something about the you had no respect whatsoever pretty much for superhero comics, which with a lot of the storylines and again, you know, some of that overstepping on rights and the continuity of it. How do you feel that this is more freeing to do that?
Well, The Boys was its own universe. So while I could do obvious parodies of characters that were recognizable enough, I never had any trouble actually with the copyright holders of those characters. So, you know, it's obviously Captain America, it's obviously Superman, Wonder Woman, whatever, but it isn't actually them. I can tell you that when I was working at Marvel and DC, and I would occasionally drop their established superhero characters into the stories I was writing on Hitman for DC and The Punisher for Marvel, which I really did just for fun to keep myself interested, I can tell you, and this maybe ties into the last question a little bit, it helps hugely if you have people at the company on your side. Mm-hmm. So whereas there were a couple of Marvel editors who tried to complain about this, I saw the forms where they'd written their complaints, and then at the bottom it would just say approved JQ. And as I say, it helps if someone's on your side. So frankly, having Axel Alonso at Vertigo and then at Marvel and Joe Quesada there as well has helped hugely. There was a glorious couple of years at the start of Joe's time at Marvel when it really felt like the lunatics had taken over the asylum. And I was able to do things like Fury, that first series, right, with Derek Robertson. And really, any objections about continuity or the dignity of the dignity of superhero characters were simply swept away. Approved, JQ. When you get to something like Dynamite, of course, it's not even an issue. Most of what I do nowadays, I own, so no one's going to be able to say, you know, the Homelander would never do that. Of course, we do.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there are any plans to do another Legendary arc, another limited series for this one.
I have no idea. I had a lot of fun doing it. I wanted to do a story in which it was just, what fun thing do I want to do at any given time? And that happened, but not one single word of Legendary was written on time, pre-deadline. So I created a lot of gray hairs down that end of the table.
It's a dye job, you can tell.
So the answer is, these are people I like. I don't know if I would want to inflict another go-round on them.
Watchtower.
I don't have the balls to.
Got them all trained. Yes.
Question for all the creators. 10 years, man. 10 years. What's your favorite issue or your favorite book you've worked on in that 10 years? Was
Charlie Wormwood.
Yes.
That's my number one.
That's con number one. Pretty much just made it.
For me, Red Sonja. That's
yeah, my stuff. Easy. Okay, say my stuff.
I wrote a war story for the Battlefield series called Dear Billy, and it couldn't have worked out better. It was based partly on a true story. It had art by Peter Schneeberg, covers by John, in fact, and it just couldn't have gone better. That's my favorite of everything I've done for Dynamite. It's damn near my favorite of everything I've written.
It's wild to say that, because the Lone Ranger is really special to me in terms of what the a large series, but I think those are some of my favorite covers.
I like the one with the bloke and the tank track, you know, going over them.
That's you hold the ones you like. It's this the lay of this war torn land, and there's these two tank tracks. And there's just is it just the legs? That's his favorite.
Actually, I think my favorite of those.
Just read Mad Magazine.
Would be, I think my favorite of the ones you did, I'd say, was the First Night Witches, which was done like a Russian propaganda.
That's probably
the Soviet era. I thought that was terrific. Mm-hmm. But also the one with the, you know, the two women in the plane at night.
That was hot.
That was a good one.
Legendary, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Actually, I have a question. Since you brought up Dear Billy, how much research do you do for the battlefield especially?
Mostly, I know it anyway, because I have this lifelong fascination with military history. In that instance, much of the story is taken from real life. What happens to the nurse? What happens to the pilot when the Japanese bayonet him? Later on, the massacre of Japanese soldiers trying to cross the river. Picture of RAF operations in what was called Southeast Asia Command. It's all fairly accurate. There was a nurse who survived a massacre like that. She was the only survivor. She did not go on to murder Japanese prisoners, but it got me thinking, what if she was put in a position where she could? And that was really where the story came from. So in terms of the research for them, it's almost more like all the reading I do inspires these stories. There are some writers like Max Hastings, Anthony Beaver, Rick Atkinson, who are very good at, and Stephen Ambrose to an extent, who are very good as collectors of anecdotage. And when I read their books, I find myself wanting to write about something on almost every page. I've said this before, but I think that the things that happen in real life out there on the very edge of human experience are 100 times more fascinating than anything you can invent fantasy.
And a lot of Charlie Wormwood is based on your life experience.
Yes, I taught in prison for 8 years. So a lot of the all of the stories that are told by the prisoners in the book are stories that the prisoners had relayed to me, whether I wanted to hear them or not. Some of them I was just ignoring when they would tell them until they would say something just outrageous, you know, like there's a guy who killed two people, his wife and her boyfriend, and then decided to exchange genetic material with them. It's a nice way of putting it. So I was just like, I don't want to know anymore. And he's like, well, Miss Blanche, the bodies were still viable. So, you know, they have rules. So there are things like that just we wouldn't think that's real, that all those stories are real. I cleaned them up somewhat because some of them I was like, this is too out there. Nobody's going to believe this really happened. So all those stories are real. And a lot of the things that happened to the main characters in the story, not the selling of the drugs, but because I never did that. But a lot of things happened between the character, you know, between like the prisoners and Charlie and Liz as teachers did occur. So it was just research. And that's my time in prison was just teaching in prison.
Yeah, teaching in prison.
How much research did you have to do, Dwayne, to find the beatnik con artist that is
That's my former job. No, actually, I'm loving hearing the stories from, you know, Garth and Christina. It's like that real research actually does fuel so much of my fiction. I kind of have to be inspired by a real place, an anecdote, or a bit of history. It does kind of send you off on a tear, you know. And as far as X-Con, though, actually was inspired by cheesy 80s cop or like crime movies, honestly. You know, like Cobra with Stallone, that kind of stuff. And L.A. is like my sort of dream city. I'm a Philadelphian, and L.A. is where you go to sort of get in trouble, you know. So I kind of want to go to L.A. in the 80s and get in trouble with a character who was not me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the reality actually for me is the most important ingredient sometimes for a story, make it kind of pop.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel about comics coming out more in TVs and movies?
If there are comics, great.
Yeah. I mean, comic book characters or so, and does that have any plans for that? Because, for example,
Joe Carter, you know, but you guys have World of Mars, which I think had more depth into the character than that Disney movie.
Yeah, take it, Disney.
Well, to answer your question, I think anything that brings more people to reading comics is a good thing. It doesn't matter whether it's a movie or a TV show, or if they want to come read My Little Pony or Green Hornet. Anything is anything that gets them into the comic shops and reading, you know, books by these people is a good thing.
Well, and I think, too, the exposure makes it so it's not like a dirty little secret that you carry around with you anymore, and it helps grow the audience a bit, and I think that's a good thing, and it's not always a great thing when it's a bad version of what we do, but the really good ones, when they hit, and it's kind of funny to hear people like my sister and my mom, who know nothing about comics, getting into a program on television that comes from comics, you know. So it's just exposure makes it great.
Yeah.
So I know you guys have a pulp panel tomorrow, but given that a lot of the stuff you guys have is pulp, and a lot of that was originally like really, really sketchy, how do you guys decide what's the line of what's going to be, what's allowed, what's, I guess, self-censorship in a way, you know?
A lot of the censorship actually comes from the licensors. Not that we would be for the Shadow killing an innocent person, but that is something that for Condé Nast is definitely against, the Shadow ever hurting somebody who is not a direct threat to him. That said, Doc Savage can do that. The Avenger can do that. And so, obviously, we want to be real to the characters, but the Spider is going to be the most violent of all of them because those pulps were ridiculous. Like, he fought, like, nations of undead, like, zombie people, and, like, in one pulp just like decimated them all. It's like, all right, cool. Whereas,
have you ever read any spider stories? They're the scariest screws. The Shadow is like, oh, I'm not going there. That's mean.
But yeah. So what we like to take it to the limit so long as the limit makes sense. You don't want to exceed the boundaries of any character, otherwise it's like giving Batman a gun. Like, nobody's going to believe that. So I hope that...
Yeah, perfect.
Anybody have questions? Comments?
Is Nick dead?
Yes.
I think so. We'll have a whole funeral tomorrow.
God, imagine if he actually was, and we're sitting there.
Oh, my goodness.
He's lying in this hotel room,
face down in a pool of vomit.
And we're all, wouldn't it be funny?
Oh, no.
I would still laugh, actually.
You're good friends. You're good friends.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
I'm just curious about something. Right after World War II in Japan, comics expanded both, you know, in depth but also outward in terms of the range, the number of genres that they were covering. And we're starting to see that same movement decades later here, where you've got comic books that, you know, used to be just funny animals comics, the occasional horror comic, and then the rest is like Masks and Capes. But now we're starting to see the breadth of comics. You've got political thrillers, you know, like Evil Empire and some of the other stuff. You've even got sports-themed comic books. We're starting to see that, you know, I don't know what to call it, mangafication, whatever, of the American comic, where it's expanding the breadth of genres covered. And Dynamite seems to be doing a lot in that direction. You're covering a wider range of stories than a lot of the other presses are covering. And I'm just curious, where do you see yourselves in that expansion of the breadth of genre that you're covering?
Well, I'm all for it.
Likewise.
That's what I'm all about, what I've been about from the beginning. I mean, I find superheroes to be, and I see this is a very popular view, and I think Mark in particular would agree with it. I find superheroes to be a terrible blight on a great medium. I like to see as many different genres as possible. I mean, in the past couple of years, I've tried to do as many. I did crime, science fiction, action, war, dogs. I try to do as many different things as I possibly can, because I came up in the industry at a time when Alan Moore was kind of at his height, and what he was saying was essentially, we can do anything. We are like TV, prose, poetry, plays, movies. We can do anything. I think you're right that we are seeing an expansion. It's just not happening as fast as I would like. The backbone of the industry is still superheroes. That will probably continue. But so long as there's enough space for us to do our own thing and expand the boundaries of the medium, I'm very happy.
In a funny way, actually, the way that superheroes sort of hijacked comics, Mickey Mouse sort of hijacked animation. Japanese animation went this whole different way, and they told all kinds of stories. They still are. We're still like, what's a cartoon? Well, in America, a cartoon is, you know, for children, and that's it.
I like cartoons.
You are a cartoon. I think we're finally getting over the seduction of the innocent. Like, people are finally realizing that comics aren't just for kids anymore.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Comics used to be a mass medium. They were invented as a mass medium. And through diligence and sweat and toil over the next 40 years, we successfully turned it into a niche market. So, go comics. And so, you know, now, luckily, again, we seem to have hit peak superhero, which is great, and it's somebody who owes his career to that. I'm still okay with that, because we need comics in all sorts of genres. It's not comics is a medium. It's not just you can tell any kind of stories you want. And I'm very, very excited and very hopeful about what I've seen just in the last 2 or 3 years in terms of the expansion of things that aren't superhero comics and the success of things in the market that aren't superhero comics. And I just think that's going to keep going.
Yeah.
Because the last one works so well, one more for the creators. What Dynamite book that you haven't worked on would you most like to? And what book are you at?
2005.
Balls. I would like Highlander.
Really?
Highlander. There can be only one, you know.
I would like to be that one.
Highlander. Anybody else?
I've got an idea for the first 3 pages of a Red Sonja story, and I should never be allowed to write it.
No offense, but you probably want to be allowed to write it.
Nikki did once say to me that he was circling around getting the rights to Dirty Harry.
Oh, yeah.
I would be straight there.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that'll ever happen.
No, I don't know. I know I have a Lone Ranger story in me somewhere.
Like Green Hornet, Lady Green Hornet.
Green Sonja.
Yeah.
One for Owen and Twain. You're familiar with the comic Torso.
Yes, oh yeah, of course.
Is there a actual crime that you would love to take into a graphic novel and present?
Yeah, whatever happened to Nikki Baruch?
I'm going to get fired for all these.
Oh God! I mean, I kind of like Torso, kind of unknown until like Bendis kind of believed it was. God, there are a lot of them. Jeez, not coming to mind. I mean, I have a lot of things I'm kind of following. Actually, I'm more of a Philadelphia guy, so there's a lot of Philadelphia crimes. And actually, my great granduncle was killed. He's a cop. He was killed. I'm going to actually investigate his murder because it's kind of 100 years ago. And it's kind of a weird death, and the guy who shot him became a local mafia lord. It's kind of funny, the rise and fall of
the
guy.
It was me. I was the mafia.
So that, I mean, honestly, personal, but like kind of local for me is what really fascinates me. You know, seeing, I actually went to the place where he died and touched the tile where he bled out on 100 years ago. So that kind of stuff, you know, makes the voices stop in my head. So,
did you see visions when that happened? Did you?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think this might have to be our last question.
So make it really good.
Yes.
Wonderful. So in terms of these primary sources, I mean, we see more oral histories now than ever. The digital age has allowed, you know, tweeting, you know, primary sources to really just, you know, speak to the individual all the way up from, you know, let's say, like, you know, laboring, like, a true demonstration of all classes. So you say, you know, having a narrative speak directly to you, like, have any of you ever found a particular narrative, a primary source, be it a manuscript, be it an oral history, that has inspired you to write a story?
All the time.
Of course.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, like I say, I mean, when I read a lot of these military histories and so on, and I read these real-life experiences of people, I find them just beyond belief. I really do. I couldn't, you know, just off the top of my head, I couldn't give you any one specific moment, but I did just finish a story for the new War Story series about Irish soldiers in the British Army in World War II who, even though their own country was neutral, joined the traditional Irish regiments in the British Army because they wanted to fight the Nazis. Later, when they came back to Ireland, because they technically broken the law, they were the subject of something of a hate campaign orchestrated by the government and the church, and they suffered this for fighting the Nazis. The men who in particular left the Irish army to join the British army were only given an official state pardon in 2013. I thought their story deserved to be told, so I did. I wrote one, and it'll appear about a year from now in the new War Story series.
And on a more personal level, we just bought a home, and the house is from the Victorian era, and the guy who owned it kept a diary for the entire time that he lived in there, in the house, for like 80 years. So we have those diaries, so that's something that I want to write a graphic novel about, you know, about his life and that whole, you know, the story of this house.
The idea is to capitalize on it in a timely way. And in an old magazine called Science 83, I believe, before Discovery took it over, there was a little blurb. It's a science magazine. A little blurb about how we might recreate the dinosaurs someday by getting genetic material out of insects that have been covered in amber. And so I snipped that out and I set it aside and said, there's a story there someday. And I sat on it for many, many years while Michael Crichton did the same thing and you know, created the multi-million dollar industry that he did with Jurassic Park. So, yeah, there's a lot of times that said original sources come by you and the lesson is to pay attention, steal it immediately and act on it in a timely way.
I feel, too, that if you sit down and take a look or read a history book of any kind and it doesn't spark about a million story ideas, you're probably not wired to be a writer.
History in general.
It's just, I can't sit down with a book like that and not, you know, come up with some idea that I really am dying to tell.
I'll make you guys a recommendation, actually. A book called Inferno by Max Hastings is sort of a people's history of World War II. It's the experiences of as many participants as he could find. Everyone from a U.S. Marine in the Pacific to a housewife in Leningrad to a British fighter pilot to a Nazi death camp guard. Everyone, soldiers, civilians, all of them, their experiences and their take on probably the most momentous event in all of history. 5 years in which 60 million people died, that's a lot of stories. I would check that out, and you'll see, I think, a prime example of what we're talking about, how you can't not write about it when you're finished.
All right, thank you.